The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
It's time for our non-fiction books of the year, and we're joined again this year by the Minister for Finance and the best read politician in the country, Pascal Donoghue, and also by, from the Times Ireland edition, Lee Sand. Okay, as it happens, I know that Lee, most of your picks have been read by Pascal Donoghue as well as the ones he's brought in. Donald Trump books dominate your list.
Yes.
What's the best?
The best is actually a book that isn't directly about Donald Trump at all. It's The Fifth Risk by Michael Lewis. And it is probably the scariest. It's a scare before bedtime, because once you read that, you know, you're reading it and the hair is going back up on the back of your neck. It's a very clever premise. Of course, you know, Michael Lewis has been there before. He wrote The Big Short, which was a terrific book and an even better movie about the stock market, about the crash and the financial crash. And this book, what he does is he goes behind some of the government agencies and that, you know, how America's are run.
And how important they are, despite the fact that there's this political narrative that government is overweening and it's an assault on American liberty. He actually points out just how important it is to everything.
Well, I mean, this is it. I mean, just, you know, there's 2 million people are employed by the US government, and about 1,200 of the people are actually employed directly by an incoming president. So, and these are people that run literally everything from where the nukes stored, if we get an outbreak of Zika, you know, who's going to look after that? What happens if, an IBM suddenly appears over the skies in Kansas? Who looks after that?
I mean, that's an interballistic missile rather than a computer, I take it.
Yeah, did I get that wrong?
Sorry. Right.
Okay, well, it could be either. I mean, you know, both are probably heading towards obsolescence anyway. But this is absolutely fascinating. And the book actually opens with this amazing scene where one of the government departments, you know, they're waiting for the changeover the day after the inauguration. After, when Obama came in, you know, his people came in, an orderly team, and the handover was orderly. And this particular agency had, you know, painted the place and were ready with big books in order to, you know, explain how it works. And nobody turned up. And like, just literally nobody turned up.
Well, as it happens, we had Michael Lewis here in the studio recently. We did a lengthy interview, and we actually have put together a podcast with James Comey as well and others, which is available on our website. So I would think The Fifth Risk actually is the best book of the year, nonfiction, that
absolutely.
I've read.
Absolutely. I mean, the hair-raising stuff.
I haven't read it, but I've heard it's great. And it strikes me that for so long we've used the term bureaucrat as a term of abuse.
Yeah.
And I think that book is probably the best rejoinder to that idea.
It shows you, I mean, there's so many smart people that were, you know, that went in. It is very much a kind of a love poem to the public service and people who work there. You know, people go in for selfless reasons and, you know, proven valuable. But just to give a very quick example, there was the outgoing CFO, Chief Financial Officer of the Department of Energy, was a guy called Joe Hazier. He was, you know, he knew everything. And he literally heard nothing about who was taking over. His contract came to an end and he left. And one of the things that he sort of overlooked was the Department of Energy's, you know, annual budget is $30 billion. And $2 billion of that goes to hunting down, you know, weapons grade plutonium and uranium at loose around the world so it doesn't fall into the hands of terrorists. So, you know, stuff like this, the electricity grid, you know, everything that actually looks after security of America. And under the Trump administration, it's just, you know, it's okay. Tumbleweed.
Pascal, one of your picks that I want to start with is not one you have in front of you there. I think Timothy Snyder, because last year, On Tyranny was one of the best books of last year. You've gone for The Road to Unfreedom. What's this about?
So The Road to Unfreedom is builds on the book last year, which was called, as you said, On Tyranny, which is all about the concept that democracy is maybe a little bit more fragile than we think it is. And that fragile, and that democracy is also capable of being subverted both at home and by influences from abroad. And actually, the beginning of the tale, much of it focuses on what happens in Ukraine when Russia invaded and took control of the Crimea. And Timothy Snyder, who's an American historian, goes into the techniques that were used in the Ukraine and shows and argues that they were used in America and then used in the United Kingdom. And it's a very sobering reading. And even if it's only half right, and I suggest it's a lot more than half right, gives us a lot of food for thought here in Ireland.
He's also a tremendous writer. On Tyranny was so beautifully sparse in its writing. It was so easy to digest. Is this book
this
the same?
This is exactly it. So the title, as is the case with a few of the books that I've mentioned, is a little bit off-putting. The Road to Unfreedom sounds like some kind of French philosophical tract that maybe Lise here would read rather than me. But it is so clearly written. And it is contemporary history written with the eye of a journalist with great style. And he really goes into the kind of impulses that are causing such a challenge for democracies, but then goes into how they have been combined with the use of technology by potentially other governments to influence outcomes. And it really, as we face into European Parliament elections next year, as we face into maybe further decisions on other big things in the coming year as well, it really makes you think about how technology can be used in ways we probably can't even imagine. But this book not only imagines it, it shows it.
Okay, I want to go back to you, Lise, for two Donald Trump books. Mm-hmm. One which was released in January and the other one later in the year. The one in January, Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff, which still stands up as the most entertaining non-fiction book of the year. It's fantastic fun, even if you wouldn't necessarily believe all of it. And then Fear by Bob Woodward, which I would argue isn't the best written book and sort of has gaps all over the place. I felt quite actually unfulfilled by it.
I would go along with that. I mean, you know, Bob Woodward is just—he's
an iconic figure.
He's a storied figure. I mean, he, you know, and he also, I think, in something that is becoming increasingly rare, but is actually increasingly of importance in journalism, particularly in American political journalism at the moment, is he has context and he has a hinterland of knowledge and first-hand experience of dealing with administrations and particularly ones that are potentially corrupt. You know, he obviously was one of the, you know, the mainstays of exposing the Watergate scandal, and which eventually toppled Richard Nixon, and now Groundhog Day, here he is again, and you know he employs the same technique in the book Fear, insofar as there's a lot of imagined dialogue, and it's very hard to separate who the sources are and who the sort of, and that can be very frustrating.
It becomes very, very, very frustrating at times because you don't know, is he himself or is he actually putting something other person's point of view across?
And that can be,
and you're trying to work it out, and it jars as you stop reading it.
I think it was a technique that Woodward and Bernstein developed for the All the President's Men, simply because they had so many sources to protect. And, you know, that style of journalism back in the early 70s was quite unusual, to write an entire book or to produce stories that got on the front page with absolutely unattributed sources, because there was, you know, there was a genuine fear that, you know, there would be retribution.
Yeah.
So this style is back again. Now, that's not saying that the book isn't without merit. I mean, it is a very interesting book. And of course, there are a few absolute gems in it. I mean, the fact that he wanted I get my books mixed up. I'm pretty sure he's the one that wanted to, threatening to assassinate the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad, or was that the other one? No, I think it was that one. I mean, you see, this is where, like, you're through the door with Trump.
Have you read these books?
I've read Fear, and that book opens up with a great chapter about an agreement, an American threat to withdraw out of a free trade agreement with Korea.
Yeah.
That the author alleges the senior staff of President Trump were hiding from him.
Well, they actually stole the document off his desk in the Oval Office to make sure he couldn't sign it.
So they didn't want him anywhere near us. So
Has that ever happened to you, I wonder? Do you think are your civil servants going and stealing documents off your desks on a Pascal Donoghue doesn't sign
them? Well, of course, if it was successfully done, I'd never know they were stolen. But I'm confident that it hasn't. And I want to reassure all of your listeners that much of the behaviour that's alleged in that book, you won't find in the Department of Finance or Merrion Square.
Did you read the Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury?
I read that book as well. Well,
that's hilarious.
I must say, out of any of the Trump books, that is one that I suspect probably there was a fusion of fact and maybe fiction there as well, that I found a little bit unnerving. And I think out of all of them, for me, the Woodward book at the moment has the edge.
Well, yes. I mean, I think probably, but from sheer entertainment, I mean, it was your political equivalent of a bodice ripper. I mean, Fire and Fury. Like, it really was. I mean, they were just, you know, and it was, you got the impression of this incredibly emotionally insecure and needy president that just, you know, I think his character was very well sketched in it.
Yes.
And then there's just the cast of characters around him. And of course, the disintegration of his relationship with Stephen Bannon is sort of traced through that, because of course Bannon was self-confessed main source for the book, and how that all spectacularly fell apart because Bannon felt that he was, you know, going away from you know, his agenda of, you know, isolationist agenda. Fascinating. I mean, it's a great read, though. You know, you'd kind of fly through it.
Okay, what's your next choice, Pascal?
So I'll pick a book called The World As It Is by Ben Rhodes. And this goes back to a different and very recent time in American political history. Ben Rhodes was the senior speechwriter for Barack Obama on foreign policy issues.
Okay.
And he worked with Barack Obama during his Democratic campaign to become president of the US, and then stayed with him in his 8 years in office. And I guess as befits a book that is written by a speechwriter, it's a great read. And I know a tome on foreign policy may sound a little bit off-putting, but it's really, really well written. It's written with great fluency. And he was obviously a character that President Obama had a lot of faith in, because he delegated responsibility to him for the negotiations in relation to Cuba and the normalization of relations between Cuba and the US. And the book goes in a little bit of detail into the negotiations in relation to this, who they were meeting, how they were engaging with the Castro family, and the vague surrealism of it all, because when it kicked off under the auspices of the Vatican. And it goes into how that happened. And while I wouldn't describe it as a rollicking read, it's not quite the bodice stripper that Lise here lingers after. It is still a really good and very, very clear read, and perhaps reminds us of a time in which foreign policy was at least talked about in a different way.
And of course, it also reminds us of the Obama presidency. And you've picked Michelle Obama's book, Becoming. Now, I have that put aside as a possible read over Christmas. Is it worth it?
Yes, it is. And I did approach this, I suppose, with a slightly beady eye, because, you know, I thought of this, you know, it's a chance for her to, you know, rewrite the story and gloss over the bad bits, maybe settle a few scores. But what it actually is a very thoughtful meditation on, you know, life in the White House, also of being the first black woman to be a first lady, and the difficulties and challenges and the extra mile she had to go with that. And she paints a very good picture of the sort of the loneliness of life as well, as, you know, while her husband was striving to be elected. I think he had been through 11 elections or something, and it came to the point where, you know, it was kind of like, I promise you, dear, this is the last election I'll ever run for, you know, the Senate. If I don't get it, I'll go and do something else. And she, you know, she's quite open and honest in some of the parts of the book as well, to a very endearing degree. I mean, she talks about the difficulties that they had conceiving children. And at one stage, when he's out on the road, you know, they were doing a cycle of IVF, and she was on her own injecting herself, you know, with the hormones. And you know, you did get without being whingy and moany about it, you know, you got the impression that it was quite tough for her. And, you know, obviously then she had to tread very carefully the path, because, you know, she could have run for president herself. I mean,
she's a very capable, intelligent woman.
With incredible charisma. I mean, funnily enough, when I was, just to digress slightly for one second, when I was in the States in 2008 covering the US campaign, the first time I saw the Obamas live was, like, in the flesh, so to speak, was at a rally in North Ohio, Columbus. And it was a really hot day, and she came out to introduce her husband. And by the time she'd finished the introductory speech, I'd kind of forgotten he was coming out afterwards, because she was just, and the crowd reacted to her so brilliantly. And I thought to myself, my God, this woman is a superstar. What's her husband going to be like? And, you know, I think she had to dial herself back. You know, we all saw what happened to Hillary Clinton when she went, you know, I'm not going to stay at home and bake cookies, then tried to horn in on the kind of the health policy and got shot down for it. And I think that Michelle Obama paints a really really great picture of trying to reconcile, you know, still being a homemaker to two kids who are growing up, with the first time playing a path as a woman of colour in such a position. You know, she describes going on stage when he got the nomination and doing a fist bump with Obama, and this was described as like a terrorist handshake by Fox. You know, this sort of constant, you know, wariness. She said on Oprah after, you know, when they had left the White House, when they were in the helicopter, Air Force One taking off for the last time, she cried for 30 minutes, and it was literally just the draining of the relief of the pressure of, you know. Okay, so well, it is actually worth a read.
You've sold that to me. I can't imagine Melania Trump
is
going
to... I have it at home too now, and I'm looking, I'll have to give it a read.
Good, okay. Let me know what you
What's
think.
Your next choice?
So my next book is a book called Adam Smith, Why He Taught, What He Taught and Why It Matters. And again, the title of this book is a lot more formidable than the book actually is.
Because
itself.
This is effectively the father of modern economics.
That is exactly it. So Adam Smith is the Scottish economist who gave birth to the idea regarding the effect that free markets can have in creating wealth, creating work and creating income. And he has now become associated with being the father of kind of neoconservatism, the father of the idea that there is no role for the government, that the state is always a bad thing. He's now seen as the kind of economist for whom the fifth risk, your book, Lisa, earlier on, is seen as the antidote to. And actually, upon reading this book, while the book isn't very original, it's remarkably well written in that it goes into the nuance and complexity of his thought, in that he was far clearer on matters of morality than is commonly understood. And he saw government playing a far more active role than, for example, the Conservative Party or the 1970s and 80s would have argued, or today's Republican Party would argue. So many of the politicians of today who would use him to advocate their cause
are misrepresenting him?
Are definitely misrepresenting him. And this book is a very clearly written introduction to his thought. And there's a wonderful few chapters in the middle that says, here are the myths about Adam Smith and here's why they're wrong. And for that reason alone, I would recommend it to anybody who maybe isn't interested in economics, but is interested in a kind of decisions that governments make that can affect how economics is practiced.
Okay,
it's a really good book. It's also written by a practicing politician. Okay. A Conservative MP. Where does he find the time, indeed?
Well, actually, you also have two other books with very weighty titles, The Future of Capitalism by Paul Collier and Future Politics by Jamie Susskind. Now, explain these two to us.
So, The Future of Capitalism by Paul Collier is a book by an economist that's normally associated with development economics. So, he would normally look at the challenges in relation to the developing world. And what's really telling is he's decided to use that approach to look at where the United Kingdom stands at the moment and where its politics stands at the moment. And he goes into the whole idea that polar extremes in Britain are in the process of wrecking its politics, in the process of meaning that sensible people can't develop sensible policy ideas, and basically makes an argument for middle ground solutions.
A manifesto for centrism, is it?
Something that would be close to my heart at the best of times. Mm. And I suspect that this is the book that those on the left of the Conservative Party next year and those on the right of the Labour Party in the United Kingdom might be reading with a little bit more interest.
And then Future Politics?
So when I mentioned earlier on, Matt, I had five different books here, four of which have off-putting titles, but are wonderfully easy books to read. This book now has a difficult title and does require a little bit of thought and a bit of time. So it might be the kind of book you'd buy across Christmas, but it mightn't be the kind of book you'd read during Christmas, but maybe later on in the year. This book is called Future Politics by a British lawyer called Jamie Susskind. And the thesis of this book is that we have to treat digital coding with the same care that we take the drafting of law. And if you look at all of the debate and scrutiny around people like me who draft legislation and the amount of effort that goes in from people like Lise and people like you to asking us questions about it, he's making the point that in a few years' time, the stuff that law does, like questions of redistribution, like questions of how you recognise people, digital coding will be and probably can already do that. So we now need to think about coding and those who code in the same way we think about lawmakers and those who draft law. And it's a very, very provocative book. And it's one that's really made me think. And of course, it's a particularly prescient issue here for in Ireland, because we have, of course, many of the large technology companies who are involved in this debate are located here in Ireland. And I think the more enlightened figures within that will be reading this book. I certainly hope Nick Clegg is. And those of us who care about
just joined Facebook,
and those of us who care about these issues, like me, this could be our Bible.
Former Deputy Prime Minister of Britain jumps to working with Facebook. I wonder will that ever happen to any of our politicians in the future. Your next choice, we just need to finish up here, but you have Emily Pine's book, Notes to Self.
Yes, just before I come to that, I know you're pressed for time, but I just want to give a quick honourable mention to one other book, and it's called I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. It's extraordinary. It's to try and make an extraordinary story very short. She's an amateur sleuth who became fascinated by a case of a serial killer who caused terror and havoc in California from 1976 to 1986. Thereupon, he raped dozens of women, did home invasions in lots of different homes, killed 12 people. For a long time, they thought it was three different cases. But then she went to work and she managed to she was just an amateur, but she became fascinated by the case in 2007. And she amassed lots of information and she wrote this book about him. She kind of created a profile of him. She kind of said, you know, he was probably white. He was probably certain, you know, he was probably quite young. You know, but she tracked him to the point where she reckoned that there was only a matter of time before they caught up with him. Unfortunately, she died in 2016, and the book was actually written posthumously based on all the case notes she had, 3,500 case notes. She had just literally dedicated 10 years of her life, and she died. And the book came out at the beginning of this year. 3 months later, a man was arrested, and he was charged with the murders. He was a 17-year-old Joseph James D'Angelo. He was a former police officer, and he was charged. Now, the most extraordinary thing about this was they caught him through DNA. There was a DNA left at the scene. So one of the investigator put it into one of these genealogical sites, found a match going back to somebody from the 1800s, drew up 25 different family trees, and ended up with two possible suspects, one of which they were able to rule out. The second was this guy. And they got him on the DNA from a discarded cigarette that he dropped while they had him under surveillance. It is the most amazing book. Okay. It's fantastic.
It's called
I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. It's absolutely fascinating.
Emily Pine, who was with us to talk about Notes to Self. What did you like about this?
I love this book, Emily Pine. It's six interconnected essays, and they are meditations on life, on the frailties of relationships. Mm-hmm. The first one is an incredibly poignant essay about her father, who's an alcoholic. She has another. The second one is about the difficulties of conceiving a child with a partner. And there are meditations on being a woman. There are meditations about growing old. There are meditations about the struggle to be a feminist. And it's what I love about this book, Matt. It's very simply written. It's not dressed up in difficult language. It speaks very much to the heart, and it's incredibly honest.
You're nodding enthusiastically,
Pascal.
I thought
this was a remarkable book, and I'm kicking myself actually for not including it on my list. She reminds me of what the essay can do all over again.
Yeah.
And two of the particular essays that were mentioned there by Lise, one about the huge challenge her and her husband and partner had in relation to conceiving and what that meant for them. And then the chapter that Lise refers to there about femininity were two remarkable essays.
Yeah.
And at a time in which we have seen an ignition of so many debates here in Ireland regarding the role of women in our country, how they have been treated and not treated, and we have seen an ignition of these issues in public debate through, for example, the Me Too movement, that's such food for thought for men all over the world. This is a wonderful book.
It's wonderful.
And I think and I would love to see this book in secondary schools in a few years' time. It's magnificent. And of course, the wonderful duo in Tramp Press, who are the most dynamic team in Irish publishing and business, identified this writer and have really got behind her. She's awesome.
Thank you very much. Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Finance, but not in that particular capacity today. And Lise Hand from the Times Ireland edition for joining us. And Pascal, for your reading over Christmas, I've given you a copy of my own book. I've even signed it for you.
So you can
check the index to see if you're mentioned in there. Well, certainly Fine Gael's interactions with Michael O'Leary are mentioned a lot in the book.
So both Lise and I felt that would be an act of unbearable sycophancy.
Yes.
If both of us were together, pick out the best book of the year.
But I'm shameless.
Shocking.
yeah, I'll actually give you a copy.
But
of
so
it on
thankfully,
air.
You've relieved yeah. us of being accused of such sycophancy.
Absolutely.
And both of us want to nominate Michael O'Leary.
Yes.
Turbulent times
no,
for the man who made
that.
Ryanair.
Don't do that. Oh, no, don't
yes,
do that.
Absolutely.
No,
every Christmas stocking should have one.
Leeds, neither of us are mentioned in it, but it's still a wonderful read.
That's always a good thing.
Thank you very much.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.